here I am in the woodlands of The Hague in the Netherlands, and around me is what I call my sweet nature. The nature you see around me now is made by God, made by life. And I brought this with me into existence to remind me of that sweet, tender, wondrous place within me that is in everybody, my actual source, my beginning. And all of us know how sweet it is to walk in the forest, in leafy places like this, how nourishing it is, how psychically fulfilling it is, how restful. In the woods, I am much closer to what I am essentially. And I have come to The Hague to talk to the people about love and truth and life and God and such things as my sweet nature and the earth and the world, and to help to make things clearer so that people are able to relate more to their reality, more to their earthliness than their worldliness. Thank you all for coming. This is not a chat show. Perhaps I should say the difference between what we're doing and a chat show. A chat show is always talking about someone else or something else. This is an intelligent conversation or dialogue or talk together. And intelligent means we're going to talk about you and me. Life as it is for you and me, and in the experience of all us human creatures, in our own self-experience. That's what makes it an intelligent conversation. So I'm very pleased to welcome you, Amrito, psychiatrist and writer, Vim, who runs a bookshop in The Hague and has been helping me for some years, Lizette, a journalist, who also has been helping me, and all of you have been to my meetings, so you have a good grasp of what I talk about. So let's begin.
Okay, Barry, I just have a question about your teaching, and that is the part that you call the self. In the people. Is it possible for you, for me, to define the self, what it is all about, and what it contains?
Yes. So, there is the self, and there is me. And myself is not me. This seems to be the most misunderstood area in people. Everybody thinks they are themselves. They use the word me, but they never think of me being me. Now, I think the best thing I can do to define the self is to give you a model. Mm-hmm. But first of all, I will define it so that everybody can recognize their self in their own experience. Now, where I come from, within me, the self consists of pain, emotional pain. It consists of all the pain that I have ever suffered since I was born. And pain is always recorded in emotion. And that emotion is self. You will hear it said that there is a higher self or a lower self, but to me, and in everybody's experience, as I will endeavor to show it, all self is pain and ignorance. So really, this means that when people say, I just want to be myself, it means, I just want to be my ignorance, my pain. And of course, that's ridiculous. Nobody wants to be that. But that's where our society and civilization is, in its lack of self-knowledge. So I'll just give this little model, which will help you to keep it in mind, the difference between myself and me. Myself is not me, as I shall show you. Here I am on the face of the earth, which we could say on the face of my body. And just inside my body, not where the doctors look, but inside my body, is me. And me is the place where I feel sweetness, tenderness, love, rightness, joy. And that is in everybody. And that place is what is called the human psyche. It is just inside my body, immediately accessible to my consciousness or my intelligence now. And that psyche goes down into my body, through my body, beyond my body, but inside my body, as deep as the space of the universe itself. It is never ending. And I can actually descend into me. And as I do, the sense of feeling disappears, and knowledge, pure implicit knowledge, is gained, until I can reach a place that becomes more stiller and more silent, where I can even realize what is called God. And even that is not the end of the depths of me. Now, the self, all my hurts and pains that I have suffered since I was a child, when I fell over and didn't understand why I fell over and hurt myself, and I cried. I was emotional for a brief time. When I was emotional because I wasn't understood by my parents or my relatives, when I was bullied at school, or when I was hurt due to my sexual experimentation, endeavoring to find love and ending up finding sex and its cruelties. All that, all those emotions, are stored just inside my body on top of me. And that is myself. And of course, the first thing that rises up to my brain in any situation that I have to face in life is myself. My past hurts and pains immediately rise up. And I try to defend myself so that I will not suffer the same pain that myself represents. And in most people, that starts to determine most of the decisions that I make in my life. I start to decide from myself, my pain, my past hurts, and not from my beautiful joy and sweetness and rightness that is never ending inside of me. So myself sits on top of me. And so people say, I want to be free. I truly want to be free. I feel as though I'm in a straitjacket. My life, I seem to have lost the beauty of my life. How often we hear this. It is because myself is sitting on top of me, and I am identifying with my pain, my doubts, my fears, rather than the joy that is in me, the sweetness, the well-being of being alive, like now. For me is always now. Myself consists of the past. Past hurt. Now it follows. If I consider myself, I am going to consider my hurts and pains and my fears, and I'm going to act and make decisions out of that place or position. Therefore, I will never be able to live spontaneously. But if I go deeper than myself and don't consider myself, and go into the joy of just being alive, the joy that's inside of that body, listening to these words, and descend deeper and deeper into it, I start to connect with the everlasting truth of life, which is in my body and which I am. Now, myself doesn't know anything about this. Myself is an intelligence. Just as when I fell over and hurt myself as a child, I was still intelligently present. Or I said to my mummy and daddy, "Why are you doing this to me?" I was still intelligent when I said that. Or when I lay in bed, thinking about myself, thinking about the pains I'd had that day, I was still intelligent, no matter even though I was young. That same self is just as intelligent. Only it likes to think about its pain and its hurts. And so wherever you go on the earth, you'll hear people telling their sad, sad story of how someone did this to them yesterday, how what a hard life they've had all their life, how they've suffered so much, because the self loves to talk about and consider itself, its pain. And if I'm busy considering myself and my pain, I haven't got time for me. What is me again? Well, is it good to be alive now?
Yes, it is.
Of course it is. Right. And where did that smile come from? It came from me. Because whenever a smile rises spontaneously, it comes from me. Myself is more inclined to say, I shouldn't smile. No, I'm not going to smile. I'm practicing austerity. I'm practicing being religious. I'm not going to smile. See, that'd be myself, a decision that says, I'm trying to get something. Because the self is always trying to get something. To get God. To get wise. To get some love. To get something. Because it consists of pain. And pain is always trying to get something to assuage or reduce itself. It's pain. But when I relate to the life inside of me now, I say, well, I don't need anything now. But myself, which translates into my mind, which is always thinking, would say, oh, but I haven't got a motor car and someone else has. But if I connect with me, I say, well, do I really need a motor car? Now, no. It's very nice to be alive, to walk in the park, to see the people, to be in me. Does that explain it to you? Mm-hmm.
Yes, it explains a lot.
Yes.
So it seems that because of my experience, I'm disconnected with me.
That is so.
You could call it like that.
That is so, Vim. And Lizette?
What about the positive emotions, such as joy, gratitude? Is all that also self?
I say that love and joy are not emotions. Love and joy are a state. An emotion is something that peaks, goes up and downs. Yeah. It's a condition. And a condition is not a state. A condition is always a part. And a state is a whole, a continuum. So I say that if anybody is me, meaning in their own body, they will feel the state of, say, well-being, for it is good to be alive. And that's a definition of well-being, when I feel, oh, it is good to be alive inside of me, then that's the state of well-being. It doesn't have any part to it. It's just there. It's a state. So no excitement in it. You could call it the joy of well-being, or I could just feel the joy of life. Now, this joy doesn't have any object. I'm not joyful because I've won the lottery. I'm not joyful because I'm going to a party. That's all partial joy,
yeah.
Exciting joy. That's emotion. If I get excited because I'm going to a party, there's a tendency to go into emotion there. This joy of me, of being alive, is an evenness that is always there. And what the self does, it looks for peaks of excitement, peaks of joy, peaks of love, to love somebody. Now, it is beautiful to love somebody, but it does represent the possibility of emotion because it means I'm loving an object instead of feeling the love within me first. If I can feel the love within me first, the joy, the state of equilibrium, of well-being and joy within me, then I am better able, equipped, to love somebody. But if I only love somebody first, I will start to rise in an emotion of excitement and attachment, and sooner or later, they are going to die or leave me, and I will know what is called heartbreak.
What about being moved in the sense that, for instance, when I read in one of your books or listen to one of your tapes, I'm being touched so deeply that I'm moved so deeply that it brings tears into my eyes. What about that?
That is brings you in touch with the state of love that has no object within your body. Now, when you connect with that, it is such a beautiful place that the part of you that is unhappy, the self, because you're looking down to the state, and because you are responsive to that state, you weep with a beauty, with an acknowledgement that this is a sweet and wonderful place. And all my books do is reflect that place in you to you, so that you then, the part that would be painful and tense, gives up and says, ah, there is a beauty. Oh, how beautiful it is. How beautiful. And that's when the self, the pain, the attention of the pain, starts to turn inward. You get this arising of the sweetness, and the tears arise as you acknowledge a place that is not myself. For anyone who has ever had a religious experience, and I'm talking of religion in the sense of self-knowledge, will always say, it's so intimately personal, and yet it wasn't myself. Of course it's not yourself, it's me. It's that beautiful state available in everybody, which everybody contacts and lives in so often, but then their self or their mind comes across and doubts it, or accentuates their unhappiness and pain, and they want to talk about how unhappy they are instead of how good it is to be alive now. What would you like to say?
Oh, just
that?
One more question about this point on me. Do you basically equate it with being? To be deeply into me is to be in the state of being.
Indeed, Amrita.
That is really, and that is consciousness itself, which is the joy.
Yes. Although in being, because me is infinitely deep.
Yes.
The joy, which can be a feeling, gradually disappears as a feeling,
right,
and becomes an implicit knowledge.
Right.
And then I can say, as so many people will say, I know I love you. Often when they say that, they will not feel love.
Right.
Many people say that. I know I love you.
Mm-hmm.
That's implicit knowledge. For this love that I have for somebody, its source is me. And that source is knowledge. I just know I love you. So yes, and that comes from the state of joy, love, and then deeper, deeper into consciousness, and then into being, and then consciousness disappears in being because there's nothing to be conscious of.
Right.
And there's no I to be conscious.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just in a state of being. And everyone lives in the state of being. When they walk through the park or down the street and they're not thinking about anything, and they see the sky and they say, what a beautiful day. That's the state of being.
That is being.
That's being. There's no interpreter, no monitor, no thinker. Because you don't have to think about a beautiful day. As soon as you think about it, the beautiful day is gone.
Right.
You're in the past, because you can only think right. about the past.
I always had the feeling that that state of being you're talking about, you have a quality of presence in it. Is it just an absence of everything?
Or does yes, Jim. Presence that you speak of, that this state of being has, is actually a state of absence. It is an absence of myself.
Yeah, I can imagine that. But I'm always seems to weigh that there's some more state of
that's
quality of vibration. I don't know how to call it.
Yes, some positivity is what you're looking
Something
for.
Something like that, yeah.
Now me, as I go deeper and deeper into me, beyond myself, I lose the positivity. I start to go into negation, which is absence. I go beyond yes and no. I go beyond good and bad. I sink into absence. And absence is the place.
Absence is the place.
Of presence. Then I am present, not as I and not as me. Both have disappeared. I am then like an emptied, I am a shell. Such as if you look at me now, I am a shell. I am precisely what you see. The form of a man. But do you know there is nothing in here? There is nothing inside of me. Mm-hmm. And if you looked into me there in that body, listening to these words, you would, if you don't consider yourself, you would see the same thing. There is nothing in me. And when there's nothing in me, I am free.
How can I be sure?
You cannot be sure because that's yourself asking me, how can I be sure?
Right, so then I can't ask anything.
You cannot ask anything, you can only be it. Then all the questions disappear. That's but true. You have been taught by your society to ask questions, to want to know where I come from. Seek and you shall never find. Be. And there you are. Because we are taught to seek, because we are taught to try to know, we cannot find. We cannot be. Go on,
that's the end of all, I mean, nothing to say then.
It's the end of all doubts, all questions.
That's true. That's true.
It has to be. The master doesn't have any doubts, and he doesn't have any questions. Except, where's the nearest telephone, please?
How can I be sure that I'm not trapped in a self then anymore? In a way of self-delusion, you know? Just a relaxed self.
Is it good to be alive this moment, Vin?
It is.
Are you enjoying
yes,
life?
Yes, enjoying life.
Then you are not in self. You are only in yourself when you are considering yourself, your unhappiness.
So the self never can enjoy anything?
Well, no, it can't enjoy anything except excitement. The self always enjoys excitement. And excitement always ends in a peak.
Yes, I can see.
Like a good night out and a good party, isn't it a pity it's over? So as soon as the party's over, ah, like the children say, have we got to go home? Oh, and they start to cry because they got excited. Whereas the mother and father should have told them, look, life consists of going and doing things, enjoying them while they're there, and then immediately, as soon as they're finished, that was good. No need to go on. As soon as something's finished, just wait and be still and something will come again. But we teach them to get excited and then to reach a peak where somebody takes it from them or it ends, and then they get disappointed. Now, self-consideration. If you want to be free of unhappiness, which is the state of me, of being, mm-hmm. for what's the good of being if I'm not free of unhappiness? You must not consider yourself. Now, everybody considers themselves. All day long, everybody is considering themselves. When they live together, they consider themselves. So it's not long before the two selves are considering themselves, and then there's two. And as soon as you have two selves together, you've got argument and dissension.
That's true, yeah.
So the only way to be free of unhappiness is not to consider myself. Now, I do not consider myself. What does it mean to consider myself? It means to reflect on my pain, what I should have done, what I should not have done, what I should do, what I should not do. To reflect on my feelings is to consider myself. So if you ever want to be unhappy, you'll find yourself reflecting on your feelings, and as soon as you do, it will not be long before you are unhappy. You will be guilty, you will be resentful, you will be depressed, you will be angry, or one of those emotions.
Yes, how is it possible then in my daily life to act as a person without reflecting to myself, just doing my things? And
well, what do you want to reflect on? Let me ask you that.
Well, I don't know, really. You just have to do your things, daily
things. Will you tell me? Yes, you can do anything you like and you don't need to reflect on yourself.
Just a straight action. Do.
Well, action is pure, isn't it?
That's
action
true,
is necessary. Yeah. Absolutely necessary. Yeah. Wonderful. So, well, how do you need to reflect on yourself, Vim?
Sometimes I have to go in my memory to remember something.
Well, now, if you have to remember where your car is parked, you're not going into yourself, are you? There's no emotion, no pain in that.
Uh-huh.
That is quite factual.
Uh-huh.
Emotion or self is not factual. It's all impressionable. Why did he do this to me? Why? What have I done to this person? That's all impressionable.
So my memory is not a real
part
of the self.
Your memory is there for you to refer to for facts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you run your business?
Yes.
You run it by thinking about how many books did I order. Then I go and check, of course, because I can't even rely on my memory too much. I've got to go and check my books to see that the number of the lists are correct.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you have to think about yourself?
Not really, no.
No, not really at all.
No.
You don't have to think about yourself at all. You don't. But everybody has been taught to think about themselves. And I put it this way. Everybody has been taught to consider their own feelings. And I come along and say, you must not consider your feelings. Now, you've been taught to consider your feelings. And I say, don't, or you will be unhappy. The next question is obvious, I'm sure. What do I do then? If I don't consider my feelings.
Sounds pretty dull.
Yes. Well, say in this situation here, you come in here for us to have this talk.
Mm-hmm.
If you consider your feelings, whether you feel nervous, if you consider your nervousness, we're not going to get anywhere, are we? You're considering your feelings. But say you consider the situation and say, well I'm here. Yes, because I want to. I've been asked to engage in this talk, and I'm going to engage in this talk intelligently and address the situation,
mm-hmm.
not my feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Then we'll have an intelligent talk, won't we, like we are having.
Mm-hmm.
So when people come and get stage fright and nervous, it means that they're considering their self, their past failures or their past possibility of failure. Mustn't do that. You walk into the situation being true to the situation, not true to yourself, which is the past, and you be true to the situation, which is always straightforward, like crossing the road. You must be true to the situation crossing the road. mustn't you?
Right. Yeah.
If you're busy with your feelings, you might get knocked over.
Mm-hmm. Barry, the first time I heard you say, "I am the master of the West," I remember it created a slight rebelliousness in the speaker. But it was a very important statement. You seem to imply that you, born and raised in the West, are capable of penetrating, in general, the Western mind, whereas the Eastern master, in his innocence and beauty, may be less capable, or has been less capable, to penetrate that specific Western mind. Yes. So I started considering this, asking myself, what does he mean with, what is the difference between this Eastern mind, or the Eastern seeker, so to speak,
yes,
and the Western mind?
I speak to the West. Yes. If anyone writes to me from the East, I've had letters from villages in India, for instance. I say, I would like to say to you, you have no need of me to ask me these questions if you would only return to your innocence and the wonder and sweetness of the East that is in you.
Right.
But as you have tasted a Coca-Cola and as you have listened to the radio, you are now Western. Mm. And I can help you by telling you, would you please give up all your Western ideas and just return to the innocence of the East that is inside you, inside your body. I am master of the West because I can define in answer to any question regarding love, God, life, truth, and death. I can actually define it in Western terms so that it is in everybody's Western experience, and I can then tell them how to reach that blessed place of the East, which is inside the psyche of everybody. For the truth is that in the beginning, if I might use those words, and the beginning is now inside everybody's psyche, there is only the state or place of innocence, which is the East. It is like the sun that is always rising. That is the East. What has happened is the East has projected itself out more and more as the sun travels to the West and travels towards its own death or ignorance. So the Eastern impulse has projected itself into matter, into materiality, mm-hmm. into mind, into monitor, into analysis, which is the very antithesis of the original place of knowledge, which is the East inside of everybody. So everything, like the sun, has gone West. And we are now all screaming in our Western society for, please, some reality, some nourishment, something to live for, rather than to live at. And that's so, as the sun sets in the West, so our civilization is now gone West, and we are starved of nourishment, of spiritual nourishment, which means immediate connection with the original East, which is the innocence inside of everybody. Now, not some thought, not some religion, not some past master or teacher, not some tradition, but now, this very moment now, I am East. I am master. I am master of West because I am master of death. I am master of the death of the East. I am in the East now, this very moment. So I can, from this place of enlightenment, which I am, I can define anything, any question you want to ask me. In your experience, I will answer about life, death, God, truth, or love. I am master of West because I am of the West. The Eastern masters can reflect the sweetness and beauty and wonder of the East, and they can immediately, for those who are willing, usually their disciples, will destroy for that time the mental structure. Mm-hmm. And so the disciple collapses mentally, the self collapses, the structure of trying to hold on to something and be something collapses. And the disciple says, ah, how beautiful I feel, and how beautiful to be in your presence, because that is the reflection of the Eastern Master. But as soon as they go outside, they build up their structure again, this Western structure of tension and wanting to know and wanting to be something. And again, they are lost. I am here to reflect, indeed, the East, which I do, but also to penetrate through the labyrinth of the Western need to know, the Western need to be, the Western need to achieve, the Western need to acquire, to possess. All this is Western. Mm-hmm. In the original East, there is no need to acquire, to achieve, to do any more than what you do, because action is pure. And if I can only return to pure action, there are no more problems in my life. But you know, it is the Western way never to take action, never ever to take the fundamental action. Everybody is running around taking the secondary action, but never the fundamental action. What is the fundamental action? The question is, why are you unhappy? If any man or woman on earth is unhappy and they come to me, I say, why are you unhappy? How dare you be unhappy? What are you unhappy about? Tell me. Tell me. They say to me, I want love. Or they say, I'm sick of myself. I say, would you please be specific? Don't give me any of that nonsense. Why are you unhappy now? And it is because the West will never face that problem. They will always nip off to the movies, have a drink, do something exciting, take a drug, instead of saying, why am I unhappy at this moment, and what am I unhappy about? That is specific. I am master of the West because I am utterly, completely specific and practical. The East is not practical. The East is a place of magic. You know, magic is not practical. It is magical, the East. But the West is practical. The West puts a man on the moon, tightens up the nuts and bolts of motor cars. The East says, ah, love one another. The East does not tell you how. The East tells you about. But I want to know how. And the only question is, what are you, man and woman, unhappy about now? And be specific. Don't give me second thing first. Mm-hmm. Give me first thing first. Then I can help you to free yourself.
If the Western mind, the Western man, is very worldly, into the other, oriented towards the other person, heaven is in your arms, so to speak, which the Eastern man may be less inclined to say, then you're saying that's why the Western man, being so much involved with the other, has to clean up his act. He has to get his life, which is at the moment very much into the other, addicted to the other.
Yes.
It has to be gotten right.
Yes.
And that, you say, the Eastern mind is less capable of penetrating.
Yes.
This mess the Western man has made of his life, or woman has made of
his life. Well, the Eastern mind can't, because the Eastern masters haven't had to contend with that.
How do you mean that? Not to contend with that?
Well, an Eastern master hasn't had the experience that I have had at the West. No chance.
True.
No chance.
That's true.
No chance. He can't do it. He can't even handle the West. He can't handle it. He doesn't know what to do. Can't handle it. This is a very material,
world.
Mental,
yes,
cruel, competitive world.
So Ramana Maharshi, when he would be suddenly sitting in New York, would not know what... He would get back to his mountain.
As fast as he could. He couldn't handle New York.
Yeah, yeah.
I can handle New York.
That's the point.
Yes, I can handle anyone who wants to talk to me. They can talk poetry. Eastern masters will talk poetry.
Yes.
But poetry doesn't solve anything. Poetry is beautiful. But it's no good to find enlightenment. You can be enlightened in the moment while you read beautiful poetry or something that is enlightening in the moment, but enlightenment is an uninterrupted state of knowledge, of never being unenlightened again, not just partially for a while.
So Western man is cunning, clever, addicted to the other, and in a mess.
That is so.
And you, as a man of the West, who has gone through the experience of the West, is more capable of penetrating that mess. And
I know all his tricks. Every one of them. Because I know myself. I am he whom I deal with. I am he.
You've gone through.
Every man is myself.
That's right.
And myself is pain, unhappiness, yesterday, the past. And I know myself. Therefore, I know every man. His unhappiness. And because I am me, because I am master, I can show him the place inside of him where this place is. I can take him there if he's willing. If he is not willing, I have nothing to speak to him about. Why should I? I'm not here to teach anybody who is not willing. But if he is willing, and he wants to come all the way, I will show him the way. But it will be not out into the other. It will be back into myself. And as he goes back into, he or she goes back through myself, my goodness, it is horrible. Because the only thing I have to go through is myself. No one else. I made myself on the way out. And to go back into me, the place of enlightenment and peace, I have to go back through myself. It's like turning round and facing a monster. So everybody in the West is running from it like mad.
That's right, yes.
I can't face myself, they say. And I say, you must face yourself. For that's the only way back. Yourself is the guardian of the threshold of enlightenment. There's no other monster. It's what you've made yourself that you must face. And this is horrible for all of us.
Is this Western mind or Western man so phobic about this message because they know intuitively that when they go inwards, so to speak, the kingdom is inwards, inside, you're liable to die to everything that you are not? In other words, that is a fear of death so much prevalent in the West, and therefore refusing to go inwards.
You are facing death. You are facing the death of everything. You are facing yourself.
Thank you for this beautiful clarification of the Eastern Master and you as a Master of the West.
Yes.
Yes, Mary. You said that we have to face ourselves. But how is it possible that the self is looking to itself? I mean, it sounds a bit contradictory to me. What part of me is looking to?
Right. Now we have three things here. Let's identify them in your experience.
Yeah.
There is myself, mm-hmm. which is pain and always wants to be thinking about itself, considering itself. There is me, which is the joy, the rightness, the feeling, no negativity in me. What makes these possible to be registered? My intelligence. We have intelligence which can be called perception, which can be called attention. So it's a matter of where my attention goes, my intelligence, my perception goes.
Can you define that, attention?
Attention. If you are looking at the speaker now, that is your attention. If I asked you to think about something, you would put your attention on some memory, and that would be your attention, wouldn't it?
Right.
Right. That's your intelligence or your perception, whichever word you like to use for it. So, the key to it all is this attention, this perception, this intelligence. Where am I going to put it? Am I going to reflect, because that means putting attention back on myself, my feelings, my pain, or am I going to put it instantaneously into the joy of life that is inside of me now?
And go straight to.
And go straight into now. No past, because you can't have any joy in the past, because that will remind you of self, of yesterday, and then you will start to think about the past, and you leave the present, which is now. You can't hear a bird sing yesterday.
That's true.
You have to hear a bird sing now with your attention. You've got to register it. Because if you're thinking about how unhappy your life is, your attention is not going to hear the bird. Your ears might hear the bird, but it won't be registered by your presence, which is your attention. So if I walk through the park, attending on me, the life within me, that is immediate and present now, then all my senses are open to what is happening now. And I will hear the birds. I will feel the breeze. I will see the flowers. And I will see the people. Mm-hmm. Because my attention will be immediate, present in my senses. Whereas if I'm out of my senses, which means to be a bit insane, I will be in my mind thinking about the past. What I'm going to do, or what I did do, or what somebody did to me, then my attention is not present.
So the more I'm capable to be just here in the presence, the less self I will develop.
Absolutely. And there's only now. Now, if I am unhappy about something and thinking about something instead of being present now, the question is, what am I unhappy about in my life? That's the honest question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What am I unhappy about? If I will only address that, I will then be able to say, ah, yes, I'm unhappy about this, and I can take some action.
It's not always so that the thinking process starts when I am unhappy, only then?
The thinking process starts when the self gets bored, because it's been taught that I want some entertainment. I want something to do. My attention, which has been focused on myself all the time, most of my life, wants something to do.
Yeah, that's...
So, the spiritual life is supposed to be about putting the attention on something inside which is so subtle that it's not exciting at all. So my attention that's been on myself gets bored with that. And I have to refine my attention so that it becomes so subtle that it's able to be on me, the subtlest of the subtle, and not get bored. Now that's the spiritual life, isn't it?
Yeah. Thank you.
Can I ask something about this East and West business too, Barry?
Yes, Lizette.
Well, because... many concepts and religions and philosophies from the East are extremely popular in the West right now. And one of them, a very important one, it seems, is Tantra. There are Tantra workshops, and, well, I have attended some of them. And now, having been introduced to your teaching, I see that they are almost totally opposite to what you teach about sex and love. Could you talk about this?
Yes. Sex and love. There is no need to go to any tantric workshop unless you want to engage in sex. To love a man or a woman, and I have to speak from man, to love a woman means that I give. I'm not experimenting. I give to her. Love gives, sex wants. Tantric workshops want to achieve something. They want to be free, or they want to experience. Now, love is a state of giving. So in the West, the thing is not to learn how to make love or to experience making love at tantric workshops. The question is, why are you unhappy that makes you want to have to go to a tantric workshop? Why? Does it not mean that you are afraid to love an ordinary woman? Because that's what it does mean. There are lots of women out there. All you've got to do is love one. Give. You won't need any so-called tantra then from the East. Because tantra coming from the East is an excuse for the West to get onto its favorite subject and activity, which is sex. There is no need for tantra workshops. It's just a matter of man loving woman. Any woman that he's with. The one thing that the Western world will not do, Western man will not do, is love the woman that he's with. He goes by his feelings. He's been taught to go by his feelings. And all his feelings are sexual. Although underneath his feelings, of course, there is this rising from the depths of me, the rising of the joy and the love and the need to help to make woman beautiful and pure, for that is what man's love is for, to nourish her and to make her the woman that she is, not the woman that she's trying to be in the Western world. All he's got to do is love her. All he's got to do is say, what can I give you that I am not giving you? What can I give you to make you more beautiful, to get the emotion out of you? And woman's role then is to say, what can I give you so that you can be more of a noble man and a beautiful man, because I have much to give you as woman. What can I give you? Instead of that, I demand from you as man and say, you're not giving me this. This is what I want. Woman says to me emotionally, I want this. And we are fighting between ourselves, our unhappinesses, instead of responding from the depths of me and saying, what can I give you, Lizette? Now, if you want something from me, Lizette, that is a demand, I would say to you, Lizette, I cannot give you that. I can only give you my love, my straightness, my honesty. That's all I have to give you, Lizette. If you want something like you're asking for or demanding, you'll have to go somewhere else. I cannot give you that. Or you would say the same to me as man, as woman. You would say that to man, if you were honest. But we in the West have not been taught to be honest. We have been taught to be dishonest. And so we address each other from ourselves instead of from the depths of me. Can I make it any clearer, Lizette?
Well, I have a different question. All this is about a man and a woman living together and having a, you know, a love life. What about me? I'm a single woman right now and have been for some time. What can I do to purify myself?
Everything is right as it is. So if you do not have a male partner now, then that is right. And you must rest in that this is right. So the thing about the ordinary life is to give. If I do not have a male partner as a woman, which often happens for males and for women, what can I do is your question.
Yeah.
Give. What have I got to give? You have your sweet nature to give. Like I have my sweet nature as a man, say I did not have a partner. What have I got to give? I will give my sweet nature wherever I go. I don't mean my sentimental nature. I don't mean my kind nature. I mean just to speak to man and woman from the place where I come from. Not to give you my unhappiness, not to give you my sad story about how so-and-so did such and such to me, or so how I'm so sad today, so depressed today. That's not my sweet nature. My sweet nature is in everybody. It's a lovely day. What can I do for you? Right? If you ask me to do something that is not right for me, I'll just say, no, I can't do that for you. I can't do that. I don't have to get all tight, but to treat you as my fellow, not as my a recipient of my unhappiness. That's what I've got to give. And you will draw to yourself man, if it is right for you, you will draw man to you, a right man. But you must not give in to what you know is not right in love with any man. Even if it means you are without a man. You must not think, when you're without a partner, I'm missing out, time's running on, I'm getting older. No, no, no. You must continue to give my sweet nature wherever you go. And sooner or later, you will draw to yourself a man worthy of your sweet nature. Then, of course, it begins again. When you do draw him to you, what do you do then? Do you want me to say?
Oh, yes.
Well, then you have to be honest with each other. And you have to use the situation again. You've got to be true to the situation. What is the situation? The situation that is man and woman are together to enjoy their life together. Otherwise, why are we together if it's not enjoyable? But because we have been taught to live by our feelings, which is ourself, we will address each other as selves much of the time. Or our self will rise in the situation and demand something for itself. If it rises in me, that will upset you. If it rises in you, that will upset me. So I have to be vigilant and get rid of this self out of me, which would spoil us being together. And how do I do that? I have to be honest with you. If I wake up in the morning moody, and I get out of bed unable to look back and smile at you or give you a kiss or take you in my arms, you can bet your life that I am considering myself. I'm deep in myself. My past hurts, so I'm moody. Then I would give you the right to say to me, "Why are you moody, Barry?" And it would be my honesty. I would demand honesty from myself to say why I was moody. And as soon as I say why I'm moody, the mood starts to disappear because mood can only exist in dishonesty. But it is the Western way to avoid. To avoid the first question. Always to give a nice excuse, which is to address the second question.
And what exactly is wrong with sexual experimenting? Why is that not compatible with love?
Because again, it is trying to get. It is trying to find out. What is sexual experimentation? Say I am a boy and you are a girl and we're 14 or 16, whatever, we are drawn together. It should not be an experimentation as such. It should be that I love the smell of you, I love the feel of you, I love the touch of you. And if I had been brought up rightly by my society and by my parents and my teachers, I would have been taught that a woman is a beautiful thing and it is the most glorious thing on earth for man to even stroke her shoulder and to touch her, to smell her is a most beautiful thing. For man loves the smell, the psychic smell of woman. And I would have taught my son how to smell her, just to kiss her, to touch her hair. So he would be prepared for when this movement happens in him towards woman. He would already know it was a great privilege. So when he first reached out for woman, he would know what he was doing. He wouldn't be experimenting. He'd already know, ah, yes, I do know the smell of woman because that's why I'm attracted to this girl. And there would be a respect and an honoring and a love in it, and not a hurry, which is sex, because sex is always going for the genital area. Whereas, indeed, that's how we express our love, finally, but what about the smell of her? What about the touch of her? What about the strength of his arms that she must feel around her, and how comforting and beautiful it is? Those things. But we don't teach our children that, do we?
No.
So it begins with a dishonesty or an ignorance. And unless I have prepared them for that, they're going to go for the genital excitement, which is sex. If it is not embracing of the other that I've spoken of.
In those tantra workshops, as far as I know, a lot of fuss is made about fantasizing. Fantasizing is being advocated as a good thing, a thing to enrich yourself with.
Yes, I have seen this wherever I've gone around the world, and in magazines and advice from teachers. Yes. And as you know, I say that fantasy is the cause of all of man's unhappiness, and therefore woman's unhappiness. Because man, while he fantasizes, can never love her. For he has a phantom woman. If he fantasizes, there are three of you. The phantom woman that he's fantasizing about, and you, the real woman. So if he tries to love you through a phantom, you are going to be psychically disturbed by that. Oh, he might get away with it, or seem to get away with it, but you will be psychically disturbed, and that will make you emotional, because he is not being true to love, true to the situation, which is to love you, without having to go through some fantastic realm.
What about women's lib, Barry? You say the new world will be not man's world, not woman's world, but love's world.
Hmm.
But how does woman have to liberate herself to reach this?
Woman must be in command of love. The Western world is the world of sex. And of course it is right through the East and everywhere. The whole world has gone west. It is a sexual Western world. Woman is the custodian of love. Man everywhere is possessed by sex. It has possessed him, just as the West has possessed the world. The only hope is woman. She's in a mess, because she's so emotional that she can't speak straight to man and can't be in command of love. Woman has to first of all learn to be straight. Learn to know not to compromise because she's missing out, or because she fears she's getting old, that she'll settle for sex. She has to say, like all the women that come to me, the ones that stay and listen to me, have had enough of sex. It doesn't work. They are all dying for love. And I come and distinguish between sex and love for them. They love it, because they say, yes, I haven't made love to a man for years, because I don't want any more sex. I say, of course not. Now you have to be responsible for love. How do I do that? She says. I say, you must never make love for sex again. She says, well, I'm going to be very lonely, aren't I? Mm. And I say, yes, if you want to be lonely, yes. But if you know what you're doing, something will arise in you, the integrity of love, and you will know what you are doing. And although yourself and self-interest will rise in fear, I'm going to be left on the shelf, I'm not going to have a lover. Leave it to love. There is no other way, because the other way does not work. Then, when man comes to you and says, I want to love you, you say, you want to love me? Good, I'm always available for love. And then when his actions or his words suggest sex, she says to him, you said you wanted to love me. I'm not here for sex, but love always. Then he's got to ask the next intelligent question, what do you mean? What do you mean by love you? What is the difference between love and sex? And if he's man enough to hear a woman tell him the difference between love and sex, then he is changed. He'll give up his sexuality, his sexual fantasizing, and he'll then learn to love an actual woman's body instead of masturbating and fantasizing about some phantom woman. For that's all man's got to do, is if he finds a physical woman and they are attracted to each other, then love that body. Love it. Don't love some fantasy, because that will make her emotional.
So the real woman's liberation is to liberate myself from the need for sex, the need for company, comfort, for someone to screw in a new light bulb, that sort of thing, you know, the compromise.
Yes, but there's no reason why you should not go anywhere. There's no reason why you shouldn't go and go to parties or go wherever.
Yes.
There's no reason why you should not do that. Yes. The only thing is that when man wants, does not want you for sex, which does not last, which will always hurt you and break your heart and make you self-doubtful, which is what the idea of sex, sexual man always wants to make you doubt yourself, woman. As soon as he can make you doubt yourself, you're putty in his hands.
I've noticed that, yes.
Yes. But if you say, I am available for love, and only be available for love, then you are in command of love. And you won't be lonely. Because eventually, there are men out there who only have to hear from woman what love's about, who are truly looking for love. There are men out there. But the West is so seized with sexuality, and the newspapers, and the magazines, and the letters urging women to masturbate, and all the rest of it. It's very, very difficult. These are difficult times for love, as you've noticed.
Yes. Why are men always undermining women's self-confidence?
Because that's the way that he can overcome her. Because she is love. And if she maintains being love, she will get rid of his sexuality. And he clings to his sexuality as a drowning man clings to a rope. He thinks without his sexuality, he's finished. So he'll always undermine her, make herself doubt herself, make love doubt itself, and then you get emotion. When love doubts itself, you get emotional. When love does not doubt itself and knows what it's doing, there is straightness, command, with a softness, a gentleness, an easiness, but a firmness that says, I am love, man. Don't try to play with me, with your sexuality. Love me. But don't try to play with me. It's finished.
That's very beautiful to hear.
But you do have to be valiant.
Mm.
And you do have to wait. But while you're waiting, keep your sweet nature. Enjoy your life. Amrito, is there anything you'd like to say on that subject? As I've spoken about man.
I've heard you say that, and it becomes clearer now when I listen to you here, that when I am only the body, filled with nothingness, so to speak, only the senses, being present here now, that is love.
Yes.
And when there is a sexing and lusting, it is always self. It is selfing, sustaining self, reinforcing self.
Yes.
Is that as I've heard it?
Yes, now? That is so.
It reminds me of a statement that I just heard or some time ago. Someone said, talking about sex, it's the most isolating phenomenon. And then he said, sorry, it was Jiddu Krishnamurti who made that statement. You know, kind of embarrassed, he said to the audience, sorry, as if he didn't want to hurt their feelings.
Yes.
But he did say very forcefully, sex, in the sense of lusting, is the most isolating phenomenon.
Yes.
Can you clarify this a bit more? Because it's a beautiful statement. Is it a selfing?
Sex is selfing. Sex is thought.
Sex is thought.
Sex is thought about a sexual act or the female part, in this case of man.
Right.
That's all sex comes from thought. If there's no thought about sex,
yeah,
there's no sex.
You're sure there's no sex?
No sex
no
if
thought,
I don't
no
think
sex.
About it. No thought, no sex. Otherwise, here I am with woman, and
yes,
we're attracted to each other. I don't have to think about or imagine anything. Here she is, and we're moved or attracted to each other, and we talk, and then we're drawn to each other. I don't have to think about sex, do I?
No.
I just make love with her if I do. No thought. You must never think about the sexual act. You must only participate in it or do it or hold a woman or touch a woman.
Right.
Must never think about it.
Ah.
That's the error of the West. That's where the sex shops come from.
Yes, of course. I remember once that a man in your audience said, "Yes, Barry, I've heard all this, but now my penis doesn't get into erection anymore because all this thinking about sex is gone." And then you said, just wait,
yes,
because love will make that penis erect if it is necessary.
Yes.
Is that so?
Yes, because there's a transition. As I pull back from the projection of sex.
Of sex, thinking, yes.
Projection, yes. Pull back more and more. The fantasies,
yes,
no longer to keep, because my penis is used to, or that part of my brain is used to sexual excitement, lust, thought.
Thinking, yes.
Thinking. As I pull back from that, then my penis will not respond, it seems.
Gets disoriented, as you said.
Gets disoriented. And then, but after a transition period, I will start to come forward with more love and more control, in the sense, more command rather than control, of my penis. My penis will then be an instrument of love. It will have an extraordinary quality, which I call the tantric quality of pure love. For a man's penis is supposed to have the quality of God in it. So far, man has, using your Krishnamurti statement, has isolated his penis.
Yeah.
His penis is over there, and he's here. And then when his penis is in charge, it's in charge of him. He can't control his penis. The thing that man has to do in the West is to be his penis. He has to be, the whole body has to be his penis, because the penis is a beautiful instrument of love. And so that when I approach woman, I am my whole penis, my whole body is my penis. So therefore, when I touch her with my hands, I am not an isolated part called penis. I'm the whole instrument of love. So I touch her with my hands, and it's delicious to touch her, not to just go for the genitals like the penis would.
Mm-hmm.
And I smell her, and the whole activity of love is a total thing leading to the consummation of the penis entering the woman. It's a consummation, and it is supposed to change her. My penis as man is supposed to take the world out of her. For woman is the most delicate and finest of creatures, far finer than man. And she's really being love. She is not supposed to be in a projected world. And the world is an enormous strain on woman, her sensitivity. And what is my job as her man, as her true husband? It is to say, come to me and my love will take the world out of you, my woman. I will take the trembling and the unhappiness and the emotion out of you, the stress and strain of being in this world. That's what my penis is for. I will extract it from you. For where does the world that has made woman unhappy come from? Me, man. It is my world. I have put it into this beautiful creature of love. And now, as man, man of love, as Tantra, master, when I love woman, I take the world out of her. Back into myself. What a noble action. Greater love hath no man than to take the world out of his woman, back into himself. Surely, what else do they think love is for? And woman, what is she for? I am man. I am a terribly sexual creature. Man, I have a claw in me. Every woman knows the claw of sex in man. So what is she, her job? She says, I will take the claw from you, man. Just love me. And my claw disappears and becomes a man's hand that loves her and caresses her. That's her job. Only woman can take the claw from man and make him beautiful in the image of God, as he makes her in the image of love, which is God. That's what making love is for. But the West doesn't seem to know anything about this.
Thank you.
Yes, Vim, did you want to say anything?
Well, just listening, and it seems that we are back to the beginning, that the self doesn't like this whole process. So I'm only capable to love if I'm in the right place, that you called me. So the whole practice is to be more and more capable in me to even be able to love. Is that so?
You have indeed got back to the beginning. The beginning is me.